two dipole out of the ladder line. That's sort of what you're saying. There's a catch here. Let me drop. And that is a dipole in free space that's really resonant, halfway resonant, is approximately 73 ohm impedance. By making the dipole longer and then put in an extra shunting capacitor, making it longer, you can make the dipole, instead of 73 ohms, you can make it act like 450 ohms. That's pretty easy by the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. And then by putting the right shunting capacitor across the feed point, you can get rid of the inductive reactance that you've created by the extra length. And now you've got a 450 ohm dipole, a little bit longer than normal. Don't worry about it. It'll work like a charm. When you take a dipole that has been properly impedance matched in free space, now you put it inside of a Yagi structure where you've got directors in front and a reflector out back. In many cases, that 73 ohm dipole just became 20 ohms. Exactly how many ohms it becomes is a function of your particular Yagi design. Let me drop. But the bottom line is that the majority of the high performance Yagi antennas have a driven element that thinks it's a dipole, and the dipole thinks it's running at a 22 ohm impedance, so to speak. So you've got to do some extra fiddling to do this. For all of the fiddling required for him to make a 450 ohm lateral line fed dipole inside of that Yagi, without a doubt is doable, but that's a lot of modification. Assuming that his Yagi already is a successful design, he likes its bandwidth, he likes its VISWR, and it's got a 50 ohm input connector, I would rather see him try to make an impedance and balancing matching device between the ladder line and the input connector of that dipole. And a half-wave coax balance is one way to do it. What is a half-wave coax balance? I'll give you 2 sentences on that.
What about the Berkeley program? Would that help Maltic?
Yes and no. Berkeley is assuming you've got a balanced-to-balanced structure or an unbalanced-to-balanced structure. He's got the opposite. He's got the balanced-to-unbalanced structure. Berkeley doesn't give you direct evidence for how to do that. Take some other smart. So he's got a function, he's got a balancing function here as well as an impedance matching function. Berkeley tells you how to impedance match. Doesn't tell you how to balance. Other websites might tell you how to do that. But yes, Berkeley would help. Haven't got a direct application here. The way you build a half-wave coax balance is you literally choose whatever is your favorite kind of coax, make it electronically exactly a half-wave length long, including its velocity factor, bend it into a U-shape. After you bend it into a U-shape, the shield of the left side and the right side, you bring those shields together. The shield of your main 50-ohm transmission line, you bring that shield together. You got 3 shields all soldered together. From your main transmission line, the center conductor goes to one of those center conductors of the U-shaped line. And now those 2 center conductors of the U-shaped line are now your balanced 200 ohm output. That is a half-wave coax balance. It's a very low loss, very high performance device, but it gives you a 4-to-1 impedance match. If your main transmission line was 75, you would end up with 300. If your main transmission line was 50, you end up with 200. It gives you a 4-to-1. It gives you a voltage doubling function because the halfway piece of U-shaped coax, let me drop.
2QAQ with a comment at this stack. Stick.
Yeah, Glenn recognized. Because it's a halfway coax balance and you're feeding the signal into one side of it, that side you could call it the in phase. Halfway downrange is the outer phase signal. In phase versus out of phase is the voltage doubling. Voltage doubling is a 4-to-1 impedance match. That's where it's coming from. So maybe you've got a way, Glenn, of doing simultaneous balancing and impedance matching. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Mine's kind of an observation and a question. What I've done before is I've used the 400 ohm line before on 2 meters. And at one time I had this idea that I was going to phase match basically 4 Yagis back down to 50 ohms and then use them in a phase array. And there was a good article on it that I had and I built it, and it did work. but I started making measurements, like you said, going from 50 to trying to go to 400, and I tried making a bound that would match to 400 ohms. And what was happening was I was noticing a lot of loss. Now, the loss I was seeing, I wasn't sure it was the loss coming from the ladder line or was it coming from my balun device. But when I went to 4-to-1, when I went from 50 to 200, and then I matched the load on the other side by the antenna to 200 ohms, the losses were less than a dB. So it was like, okay, you know, and that was like with, you know, like a 100-foot piece of ladder line. So I'm just wondering, which side do you think the loss is on? Is it on the ladder line, or do you think it was in the balun? Case 2 QIQ.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Without further testing, there's an easy answer to that one, Glenn. A half-wave coax balun, properly built, is an extremely low-loss device. It's an extremely good balanced to unbalanced adapter. And as long as you like the 4-to-1 impedance ratio, it does a great job. So as a first step, to step 50 ohms from the Yagi up to 200 ohms, that's easy with the 4-to-1 balun, the half-wave coax balun. And so... 200 ohms of impedance into a 400 ohm line, that's something like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And in the worst case, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio never gives you more than half a dB of loss, of extra loss, because of that impedance mismatch. So we shouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep about a system that has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, with one exception. Let me drop it. Many of our high frequency, no tune transmitters that don't have a built-in antenna tuner, they start going haywire at about a 1.7 standing wave ratio. It'll start cutting back in power, it'll turn itself off. The final stage is very persnickety on those particular rigs. So in that particular case, the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is not so good. Most of our rigs on 2 meters are not that persnickety. Most of our 2-meter rigs, you could feed them into a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, and I think they would keep right on cranking and be fairly happy, if you know what I mean. So we don't have an ideal solution on this one now. I'm going to make one further guess here. By way of the half-wave coax balun, you can make a 50-ohm to 200-ohm impedance match and balancing function in that one device. Now, an additional device, if you want to be a purist, to match 200 ohms to 400 ohms, by way of the Berkeley equations, the Berkeley website, yes, very, very doable. And as long as you do it with low-loss materials, don't make it out of 40-gauge wire, if you know what I mean, you could now have a combination that's perfect if you're willing to make the investment. But before going too far downrange, think about this. Let me drop it.
One more observation comment?
I have a question. Your 200-ohm line, you may think it's very low in loss. However, you've got the resources to get a hold of very low-loss coax cable. I'm talking about 70-ohm CATV cable. There's quite a bit of it available at very low prices. So you could stay coax all the way and keep the loss down without even going over to the ladder line. And I'm a little bit worried about ladder line, 400-ohm ladder line at 2 meters. That might be at the frequency where it's starting to radiate. And if it's true, the amount of radiation is a function of length. And here's something crazy. As you use longer transmission line, by I squared R loss, you do get more loss. But if your line is already radiating, not only are you getting the resistive loss of the extra length, but the extra length is giving you more radiation loss. You've got a bigger antenna coming out of that coax cable, out of that twin lead cable, if you know what I mean. I'll go ahead with your further comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
The part that really surprised me, Dick, when I did this measurement was that how I adjusted the VSWR was how I attached the ladder line to the elements. In other words, I had a split element in the middle. So in other words, I basically had a quarter wave out one side, quarter wave out the other side of the driven element of this Yagi. And where I located the ladder line with like two pipe clamps and just kept on sliding it in and out, I was able to get pretty darn close to a perfect match, like maybe 1.1-to-1. And it was relatively broadband. But here again, another mystery, because, as I said, I was only using a 4-to-1 balun and basically adjusted the VSWR on the element itself by sliding the cable in and out on those elements. There again, hope maybe you've got an answer for that one too. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, your center dipole on your 2 meter Yagi is a dipole. If I take the two wires of the lateral line and split them apart and start connecting them, in your case, with the hose clamps at various positions along the dipole, one wire goes to the right side of the dipole, one goes to the left side, you are making what's called a delta match device. And as you slide it along that dipole and change the amount of the lateral line that you split, you do have a variable impedance matching device, and that device itself can be very low in loss, Glenn. So if you were getting a lot of loss when you did that, now we got to worry about whether or not it was the radiation of the lateral line itself at 2 meters. Was it really rated for a frequency as high as 2 meters? So was it a delta match that you were building there, Glenn? And that's a very nice variable impedance matching technique. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Pretty sure by definition, Dick, that's what it was. But like everything else, when I adjusted the VSWR there, I knew that by definition my balun was 4 to 1, and I measured that resistively by putting a resistor on the 200 ohm resistor to see the balun, to check it broadband, to see how wide the bandwidth was there, and I saw the loss was very low on the 4 to 1, and then basically what I must have done was I must have made the other end of the antenna very close to 200 ohms, which is kind of strange, because as I said, now I was using it at 200 ohms and I had excellent low loss performance and the Yagi worked quite well. But it's kind of mysterious, because I'm thinking it should have worked better at 400 ohms, but when I tried to step it up, I started seeing a lot of loss and a lot of radius, a lot of very strange things happening. And also, like, if you brought the lateral line closer to the antenna mast, it's really weird things. At 200 it was pretty happy. So here again, it was an observation at the time. KC2QIQ, back to you, Dick.
You just brought up another interesting point, Glenn, and that is lateral line at its rated frequency, for the amount of copper it contains and the amount of rubber it contains, is a very low-loss transmission line at its rated frequency. If you obey all the rules, you can't lay it against metallic objects, you can't bring it very close to metallic objects. They make a certain kind of standoff insulator that you're supposed to use on lateral line. And so in the case of coax cable that we all get used to, we lay it anywhere we want to, against ductwork in the house, against the mast of the antenna, against the tower. Coaxial cable, you can get away with murder. Lateral line, you got to obey a whole lot of extra rules. And if you go one step further, if you want to make sure that even the radiation coming off of it does not come out co-phase, you're really supposed to twist the lateral line some number of turns per foot along its length. So standoff insulators, no sharp bends, no sharp turns, not near metallic objects. If you obey all the rules at the rated frequencies, lateral line gives you a lot of performance, but you pick up a whole lot of extra other rules. But the one thing that's not clear to us now, Glenn, is that did you bring the lateral line directly to the dipole with hose clamps? And if so, where was the 4-to-1 coax balun? If you had the 4-to-1 coax balun, which is coax to 200 ohm output, where was it? Was the output leads of it going into the hose clamps on the dipole? In which case, were you feeding that with coax? So where you use the lateral line, where you use the 4-to-1 balun, you've used those words a lot. I'm not sure which one of those was where, when. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Basically, this was a test setup, Dick. I had a transceiver outdoors, and I took about 100 feet of lateral line to see how high in frequency I could get it to work. I built the 4-to-1, was mounted right next to the transceiver, so it was right there, 50 ohm connector to the two oven leads, so I could solder the lateral line onto my balun right in back of the transceiver. Then I ran 100 foot length of cable out to the antenna, and then what I did was I just split the middle of the driven element, and then used the hose clamps to clamp down to the driven element and space them until I brought the VSWR down back by the transceiver where I was measuring the SWR, and it just kept on moving positions in and out, so I eventually got a fairly good match. Now, the mast of the antenna was a PVC pipe, and it was only maybe about 15 feet off the ground with a small tripod sitting at ground level where I was doing this experiment in my backyard. But I said I was just interested that I was able to get the match kind of out in the field, but it was never something that I, you know, used on my house or something like that. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
You've now made that a lot clearer. Okay, so the 4-to-1 coax, half-wave coax balance, was at the sending end of the open wire line, and the receiving end of the far end of the open wire line went directly to the dipole of the driven element antenna, of the driven element of the Yagi antenna. And that can be made to work. That's not a bad approach. So there's many ways of doing it here. And so, before you go too far downrange, I do strongly recommend you make sure that the ladder line is used at its resonant, at its rated frequency. In the case of coax cable, you go beyond the rated frequency, you start getting waveguide modes within the within the coax cable, where some funny things happen as of impedance versus frequency. In the case of open wire line, as you go higher and higher in frequency, you eventually get to the point where it radiates faster than it transmits signal, and therefore it becomes a brand new antenna, if you know what I mean, a distributed antenna. You got a comment on this, I think you said, Wes, in 2XJN, K2RIW.
Actually, I have a question, a bunch of questions. I would like to switch to fractional antennas. There is one related to ladder line with 2 meters antenna. As I believe, if the antenna starts to be apart, I mean, if the feed line starts to be a part of the antenna, we're dealing with fractional. You may also say that every spool of wire is a fractional antenna for each range of the frequencies, or every antenna is a fractional antenna. It's a kind of convoluted, but I would like to ask you a few questions about frequency invariance and fractional antennas, if you don't mind. And to actually...
Yeah, we haven't finished this subject yet. You're opening up a brand new subject, and you called it a fractional antenna. I think we're running into a pronunciation problem here. There is a kind of broadband antenna.
FRACTAL, fractional. Fractional antennas, not fractional antennas. Fractional antennas.
Yeah, most people pronounce it fractal, even though it's got a crazy spelling. Fractal antenna is very different than what we're talking about here, and that's a brand new subject. Not now. We're still answering this particular number one of the mailbag. So I think it's about the best we're going to do so far tonight, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is check with the manufacturer, make sure that frequency is within the limits of what he's doing, and then between what Glenn said with the delta match at the antenna and that 4-to-1, whatever he wants to develop at the output of his transmitter, he might be able to get that to work, but he has to pay attention to the frequency, that ladder line. That's his first job to do, so I hope he's listening. If not, maybe I can contact him through email. Very good, Dick.
I think we're ready for your next email, John.
Okay, this is a quick one to you, I believe. I have a gentleman here who's asking about RAM, radar absorbing material. He was looking at the 117, the B1, and he noticed that it's layered with this peeling press. His question is, he'd like to know, how does it actually work? And also, what do they use on the leading edge where the high temperature is achieved? Can they use the same material? Maybe you, I'm sure you know more about that than I do, so I'll turn it over to you, and maybe you can fill them in with all the details. KC2WGB.
2FRB, one comment.
And 2FRB, with your comment. Start off with your name. I should know your project. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. My name is Russ. Just one comment. There is another ladder line that's 300 ohms. It may be used, the 450 ohm ladder line. It's also sold
to the company that sells the corporate deal. It's basically the same idea with the little ladder, but it's smaller. It's I think it's a quarter inch or yeah, quarter inch in space. The common and two airport.
Yeah, as you go to the other brands, I mean, 300 ohm twin lead for television aerials was very popular up until, let me pick a number, 1985 or so, and all of a sudden some very low loss coax cables came along, and the whole world abandoned that twin lead, and twin lead did have some aging problems as it sat in the weather with ultraviolet exposure. Eventually the rubber dried out, developed cracks, and every time it rained, the water got into those cracks, and therefore your television reception on a rainy day would disappear. So for a bunch of reasons, the popular 300 ohm twin lead of, let's say, the 50s, 60s, and 1970s, it disappeared. Nobody sells it anymore, per se. Nobody's using it anymore. And so is it really, by modern standards, the right low-loss cable? My impression from the guy who submitted that question to John was that the guy already has the 400 ohm ladder line, and he wants to use it, and he believes it's a high quality cable.
Correct.
It didn't sound like he's going to go out and buy it, so it's not quite the situation. So go ahead with your next question, John.
The next question was the RAM question that I gave you.
Yeah, I'll warn you, this is not a simple one. When it comes to radar-absorbing materials that are used for high temperature, low temperature, high signal strength, broad bandwidth, narrow bandwidth, and so on, there's a large number of materials that you can put on a, let's say, metallic surface to slow down, stop, attenuate, or whatever, the reflectivity, usually for one of two purposes. One is to lower the radar cross-section, or let's call it visibility, of your aircraft sitting in front of a radar flying through somebody's airspace. So to make your airplane more stealthy, there's a whole class of radar absorbing materials to do that. When it comes to building an anechoic chamber and to stop the walls and floor and ceiling from reflecting in that chamber, there's a whole class of radar absorbing materials you use there, and they all look very different. Now the highest performance inexpensive radar absorbing material, quasi inexpensive, are the pyramid shaped pieces of material that are put on the walls of an anechoic chamber. And the method by which it does its absorbing, those pyramid shapes are such that when a planar wave comes straight at a flat square of this stuff, so that the sharp points hit the phase front first, that kind of material is very absorbent. However, if you go 45 degrees off of bursite, off to one side, and you aim that signal at the flat surface of that pyramid-shaped object, even though you call it absorber, it becomes a reflector. And I got a great big award because I had to convince the people at the anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base that that was part of the grief that they were experiencing. Let me drop. Now, there's a class of Emerson Cumming used at first, AN-79, for instance, AN-75. AN means, I don't know, I guess Emerson Cumming. No, I was hoping the AN had something to do with their name. It doesn't. It's just a model number. This is a flat sheet of material, quite thick, and if you look at it side view, it has 3, 4, 5, 7 individual layers to it, where each individual layer has a different density, a different resistivity. You can put your ohmmeter across those individual layers and see that some of them are higher in ohms than other. And what they've done in that particular material is that they've tapered the impedance in such a way that it follows a binomial number series in order to give you the maximum amount of absorption for that level of thickness. And some of those materials go down to as low as a frequency of about 1,000 megs. The usual kinds of absorbing materials, anechoic materials used for a chamber, an antenna testing chamber, let me drop it. Most of those materials work better at high frequencies, and they start failing as you go down in frequency. And if you wanted to build a chamber
that had very high performance at 500 megacycles or lower. The pyramids become so big, the material becomes so expensive, the longevity of the material becomes so short. I mean, the materials that are sitting on the wall, when you make pyramids that high, the end of them starts folding over. Polyurethane foam that's made out of starts drying out, turning into powder. You're going to be updating that chamber every couple of years. It's an expensive procedure. To make a real good anechoic chamber at low frequencies is a very serious challenge. Most good antenna testing ranges give up entirely, and when you go below roughly 1,000 megacycles, they say, the hell with using a chamber. I'm going to use the flattest piece of land I can find, and I'm going to do a reflective ground plane antenna range test. There's ways that you can live with the reflection off the flat surface that you're standing on, and then instead of fighting it, make it part of the antenna range itself, if you're smart enough. And Dr. Dick Turin, WQIMU, had an article on just how to do that that's in the back chapter of each of the VHF handbooks, the ARL VHF handbooks, and also the latest antenna book. Let me drop it. And the article describing how to do this is hidden away under the subject of transmission lines and testing. The transmission line section of the antenna book of ARRL has the Dr. Dick Turin technique for reflective ground plane antenna range testing. So, now there's another whole class of anechoic materials that look like a brownish, grayish, rubbery substance. And that is a carefully tuned material that has a whole bunch of particles in it that are both resistively lossy, and they've got a permeability to them. A whole bunch of particles that have a particular amount of permeability and a particular loss tangent of that permeability, and these particles that are partially conductive, partially permeable, are made of a certain density, certain particle size, and they're buried in a rubber substance. You buy the right material of that kind. It is tuned for a particular frequency region. You can buy some of that material that'll give you very good performance from, let me pick a number, 750 to 890 megacycles. And it's made to be put against a metallic surface. It is peel and stick, and so it's got a specific thickness, a specific density of these permeability particles that are buried in that rubber. Very expensive stuff, and it does an extremely good job for its thickness at that particular frequency region, but it's a very narrow frequency region. Let me drop. You buy the right kind of pyramid-shaped anechoic absorber made by Emerson Cummings, and this is a stuff that's a polyurethane foam, usually painted blue on the outside, and it's got resistive particles buried into it, and you buy the stuff that's rated from 1,000 megs and above, it'll give you a beautiful performance from 1,000 megs to probably 50,000 megs. 50 1 gigahertz to 50 gigahertz, I should be saying. So, in the case of the pyramid-shaped anechoic materials, you can get extremely broadband as long as you're going up in frequency. When it comes to the very thin, very expensive materials made to be put against the metallic surface, they give you very high performance for their volume. They're very pricey and very narrowband. These are just two or three of the classes of radar-absorbing material, anechoic radio-absorbing materials. There's a whole lot of them. You start now combining frequency-selective surfaces with slot-like antenna structures along with anechoic absorbing structures. Oh boy, there's a whole art and science. And you're doing the exact opposite, by the way, when you build a radome that protects your antenna, your great big antenna in the backyard to protect it from weather. Now you're, in many cases, you're building multiple layers of material. By the way, there is something called the Schoenberg. It starts with a J. It's a hard-to-pronounce name of a guy who chews a certain resistive sheet. If you take thin sheets of material that have certain resistivity, we drop, and you choose the right combination of these sheets and the right spacing between the sheets, you now put these sheets with the right spacing in front of a metallic wall, and all of the radio signals that go into that structure, a lot of absorption occurs on the way in. What little signal is left over bounces off the metallic surface, bounces back out, and more absorption is taking place as the material, as your signal goes through those resistive sheets on the way out. And when you set the spacing just right at a particular frequency or a group of frequencies, harmonically related frequencies, the ingoing signal and the outgoing signal end up on those sheets 180 degrees out of phase, and you get zero reflectivity at one favorable angle, usually the Bohr sight angle, at a particular frequency. There's a whole class of absorbers that use that technique. So, safe to say, when it comes to absorbing radio signals to stop them from reflecting from your chamber or from your aircraft, and now to use materials that can tolerate high temperature, high velocity rain. Rain erosion is another thing you got to worry about with these materials. And some of these exotic materials that you put on the very stealthy aircraft deteriorate if they're put in the sun, ultraviolet exposure. Let me drop it. So you're forced into making a very fancy hangar that stores your airplane out on the airfield that keeps the sun off your airplane so you're not degrading these very expensive materials. And when you do a real good job of making your F-117 or your B-2 bomber, when you make it very, very low in reflectivity to try to make it invisible to that radar, when you finally get that all set up just right, you've spent a lot of money, you've spent a lot of time, and now you've got to treat it with tender loving care. You don't want a human being filling up the gas tank walking across that surface with his scuffy shoes, if you know what I mean. He can take a beautiful airplane that you're not going to see on a radar, and by just taking one walk across the wing of that airplane, he can give you an awful lot of damage. This is a little bit of that story. There's a lot of story here, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Very good information. That's something I didn't know, that peel and stick ran bidirectional in absorption, so that when the energy comes in, those different layers of different combinations of carbon or whatever they use strikes the metal. As it's coming out, it gets absorbed again. And if it's 180 degrees out of phase, no reflection at all. Wow, great info, Dick.
What is the range of the resistance of the material that is being used?
John, you've mixed two different materials together, and so that's not fair. The peel and stick is the kind of rubbery material that when you look at it edge view, it looks uniform. Quite often it's in the vicinity of a quarter of an inch, 3/8 of an inch thick, sometimes 1/2 inch thick. These rubbery material that are peel and stick, that's the material that has a whole bunch of expensive particles inside that have permeability to the particles with a certain loss tangent to that permeability, and I think there's also some resistive particles in there. When you set it up just right, with the spacing between the particles that gives you capacitance between them, and the permeability of the particles, you set it up just right, that material gives you a flat signal going into it, impedance of 377 ohms. Let me run that one by again. That signal traveling through space, it thinks it's traveling through a medium that has an impedance of 377 ohms. If you can make an absorbing material that has a three-dimensional volumetric impedance, free space-like impedance of 377 ohms, the signal will go into that material. You do not get reflection off the forward surface. The signal thinks it's going into 377 ohm material, but the material is extremely lossy, even though it's constant impedance. And the majority of the absorption takes place on the first pass before it goes to that metal plate that's behind the peel and stick layer. It's got to be against the metal plate. By the way, this high-performance, expensive material, you just hang it in space. You don't get anywhere near the performance. It's designed to be put against a metal plate. What little bit of it that has survived the loss on the first pass on the way in, on the way out, gets some additional loss, and if you can set it up just right so that at the forward surface of this rubbery repeater.
Time out.
at the forward sub of his rep. The signal going in and the signal coming back out are 180 degrees out of phase. You could, at least at one angle, at least at one frequency, get 100% absorption. The signal coming back out is 40, 50, 60 dB down. That's one class of peel and stick kind of rubbery material. There's another class of material, which is not peel and stick. And peel and stick, yeah. It is made out of multiple sheets with essentially air spacing between them, which could be a very low density foam, where the individual sheets are very thin and they have particular resistivity. And the resistivity of a thin sheet of material is not measured in ohms. It's measured in ohms per square. And some of those materials can be bought at 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 ohms per square. What that means is that if I took 1 square inch, 1 square foot, 1 square yard of the material, and if I take one whole upper straight edge and one whole lower straight edge and make them metallic, and now I put my ohm meter between the two, I'll measure the exact same number of ohms. Let me run that by again. Assume I chose a chunk of this material, which is called shim score. There's a kind of very thin sheer curtains that people put across windows. I can't pronounce it right now tonight. Anyhow, shim is the right slang that they use for it. If I picked up 300 ohm square shim material, it's very thin. It looks like, in some cases, it looks like a piece of paper that has a whole bunch of carbon smeared across it, so to speak. And now, if I took 1 square inch of it and measured it, 1 square foot, 1 square yard, and I measured it by that procedure of taking two opposite edges and making them metallic, and now put my ohm meter between the upper metallic edge and the lower metallic edge, I'll measure 300 ohms, whether it's 1 square inch, 1 square foot, 1 square yard, doesn't matter. That's why they call it ohms per square. Could call the ohms per square resistivity. If I choose the right combination of those shim materials with the right spacing between them, and now that whole structure is put in front of a metallic surface, I now, at least at one or a harmonic group of frequencies, maybe every third harmonic, I can get 100% absorption for the signal that comes straight in. There is a section of the Antenna Engineering Handbook that describes this material. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
WGB. Wow, it sounds like we could have a whole technet just on this material in itself. I recommend that he would go and read that chapter, but I don't know if that's available online without buying the book. But wait, interesting stuff. So the total thickness, you're saying it can be as thin as a piece of paper, and then different structures could be layered? Is that what this is used for?
This Chumbar or something like that is the man's name who invented this technique, and there's ways of doing it with two sheets, three sheets, four sheets. As you use more and more sheets of just the right combination of resistivities, you get more and more bandwidth out of this stuff. But for the design frequency, this stuff can, at the design frequency and the main angle of input, this stuff can give you near 100% absorption. And it doesn't care about polarization. Give it a horizontal, vertical, or circular polarized wave, it has essentially the same amount of absorption, some of these materials. But there's all kinds of ways of absorbing a signal. The materials they put around the leading edge of the nacelle of a jet engine to stop the high reflectivity you get from that outer rim, and to try to stop the reflectivity you get from all of those blades inside. You aim your radar at an airplane that's coming into your attitude, coming into your airspace. Echo you get off of those rotary vanes of the compressor stage of that engine give you a very characteristic frequency, and the person using the right kind of radar with the right kind of processing can say, oh, I recognize that sound. That's an F-15 airplane coming at me at a broadside angle, if you know what I mean. So you'd be amazed the kinds of signatures that aircraft can emit unintentionally, and if you've got a smart enough radar operator with the right kind of equipment, they can get an awful lot of information out of that echo. And for you to put the right kind of radar-absorbing materials around the nacelle of that engine to stop that from happening, there's a whole art and science to doing that. There are people who have set up whole companies that you've never heard about in the past that did that kind of work. One of those companies was in Oklahoma that did a lot of work on very fancy airplanes to stop the things that usually give you a very loud echo in an airplane, to stop them from doing it, and to use the right kind of materials that can survive high-speed aircraft, high temperature, rain erosion, snow, hail, to make materials that...
Repeater, time out.
To make materials that are tough enough to give you the right performance at the right frequencies and to survive that environment. There's a whole art and science to doing that. And the people who have developed these techniques, they hold that very close to their chest because they make a lot of money doing that, and it's a very rare black art. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Well, thank you very much for that information. I'm sure it's going to be a big help. And we better get over to Paul with the space report before we drag this thing on for next week. But very good. Alrighty. And we may pick this up again. KC2WQB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a lot more material than first meets the eye. And until recently, the majority of that information was not in open literature. And maybe a little bit of today still is not. Now, Paul, I was over at Barry's house last night to the wee hours, and he is a strong enthusiast of AMSAT. And if you go to the AMSAT website, there's a brand new satellite that they just gotten permission to launch that's going to go up to a very high altitude. And then the unique thing about this satellite is that the main bird that this AMSAT satellite is going to be piggybacked with, and has just gotten permission to do that, doesn't have to have batteries, doesn't have to have a power supply. The main satellite is going to supply them the power. An amazing symbiotic relationship going on here. And Barry just found out about that this week. And so if we go to the AMSAT website, apparently you can hear about this brand new permission they just got. WS2N. Space report number 163, I think is the number. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, we're up to 163. And I don't know about that satellite, but it sounds like it's going to piggyback off another satellite. And instead of separating from the other satellite like they normally do, you know, they'll send up sometimes a half a dozen satellites at a time or more. Sounds like it's gonna ride along with the other one and stay with it and just take the power from that. Sounds like that's what he's describing. I'll have to look into it. That's okay. They just no, there's not a lot of launches coming and going as far as you know, for the United States right now. But the International Space Station is being supplied by a new Japanese HTV-5, they call it. That's an H2 vehicle, transfer vehicle, that was launched last Friday, I think it was Friday morning. I remember watching it on the computer, and that thing, it's got quite a bit of food and bows and all sorts of stuff in a pressurized section. It's got a total amount of payload is around 10,000 pounds. And so it's going to be good to get that up there. They're going to have another crew coming up in a week or so. And that will be 9 people on board the space station. And that will stay like that for 10 days. And then one of the commanders from the flight that Scott Kelly and Karyenko were on, the, you know, Kelly and Karyenko are the 1 year, they've got 1 year in space. They're coming up to the halfway point now. They were launched in March, but they need to bring the spacecraft back. The spacecraft only has a 240-day lifespan, so they're going to bring that back. That commander will bring it back with their two other people. So it'll definitely be back to six after a 10-day visit. But they need all the supplies and stuff. So the H2 vehicle will do that. It's done it four times. This is the fifth time. They launch about roughly once a year. And they launch from Japan's launch port. Takashika is the name of the launch facility. And nice rocket to watch go up, by the way. I've seen it a couple of times. It's called the H-2B. And a little over 500,000 pounds of thrust. It's two stages. Well, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And it has four solids on it. And the solids, they make some kind of a noise. You listen to the shrill. It's a high shriek that starts to accelerate through the atmosphere. Pretty interesting. The only rocket I know that does that. There are some sounding rockets that might do that, but the only big rocket that does that. So the four solids fall off, and then another liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, the engine takes over. And that brings the spacecraft up. It takes about 5 days for them to get to the space station. And then tomorrow morning, I'll try to watch this around 6:55. The robotic arm from the spacecraft will be grabbing the H2. Another American on board, Cal Lindstrom, is going to be operating the robotic arm. He'll grab a hold of it. They'll dock it to the Earth-facing side of the Harmony module. They'll be able to unload everything for the next month or two. On board, in the unpressurized part, they have a telescope called the Calet. It stands for Calorimetric Electron Telescope, and that will be eventually attached with a robotic arm to part of the space station. It's a Japanese flight, so it's pretty much built by Japan, this telescope as well. And what it's going to study is cosmic rays. It's going to look for things like dark matter. They want to find out. Through studying the cosmic rays, they get a handle on dark matter and some other things. It's going to study the electrons that go through this detector. It's going to study protons, it's going to study ions and cosmic rays. They want to find out what really are the cosmic rays. Yeah, they learned about this stuff 100 years ago, and they still don't know what's creating it. We can't even make anything go as fast or with that kind of power with our best colliders, including the Large Hadron Collider. So it's going to investigate all this stuff. And they really didn't mention this anywhere. They mentioned it on liftoff that they had this telescope. So I wound up researching this forever to even find out the name. And then eventually I found out what it does and found out what it looked like, about how big it was, about a meter long, a meter high. And it's going to attach to the outside platform of the part of the International Space Station. Kaibo is the Japanese part. It's actually the biggest section that they have. It's about 30 feet long. And actually there's two sections involved with the Kaibo. Then they have an external platform for outside science missions. And that's where this Calais telescope is going to be attached to. I was trying to find out how many watts this thing is going to use up. What's so important about putting it to the International Space Station? Because, you could have a satellite you know, go off and do this here. They could watch this thing. If they need parts, if they want to change something out, they could do it. It'll be attached to the space station. It doesn't need to be free-flying. And it's going to use up a constant 650 watts. And they got plenty of power on board the space station. But that's, I finally found that out. They're going to plug it in, basically. And if you think about 650 watts up there, it's quite a bit of power. So it would have needed its own solar cells, it would have needed its own propulsion, it would have, you know, it goes on and on with the avionics. Now it just needs the International Space Station. Plug it in and off you go. And I mentioned that telescope. Another flight I wanted to talk about briefly is the, I've mentioned this one before, it's one that's going up in December by Orbital Science, ATK. I'd like to see that go up. It's an enhanced version of the Cygnus spacecraft. Cygnus spacecraft is the one that we lost in October. It blew up after being launched on the Antares rocket by Orbital. At that time it was Orbital. Since then ATK got involved. Now it's Orbital ATK. And they have an enhanced version. Solar panels are different. Right away you can tell there's a difference. The older Cygnus spacecraft had these rectangular solar panels coming out. Now these circular ones, and you know, each one is a circular one about 15 feet in diameter. And that'll open up a fan type of deal, producing about 4,000 watts of power. Similar to the other one, but it's a much lighter setup. So you'll be able to launch more payload. In fact, it's about 1,500 pounds difference, not because of solar cells only, but they do have an enhanced, approved engine on board the spacecraft. The engine's called the Castor 30, but they've improved that. A lot more fuel, a lot more power, and because of that, total amount of weight is going to be increased quite a bit, probably around 8,000 pounds or so, maybe a little bit more for the Cygnus spacecraft. So that's pretty much it. I mean, there's other things going on. Some company that got a patent for a space elevator type of deal. It goes on and on, Dick, but we'll get to all of this as time goes on. Back to that, WS2N.
I'm glad you mentioned that one, Paul. I intended to give you a copy of that email, of that website that I found, one of the electronic design news, or one of those magazines that I subscribed to the online version of it, talked about this brand new patent for a space elevator, which is done with inflatable devices. In other words, By having these pneumatically stiffened structures, you're going to create this very tall tower that's going to become a space elevator. And so a patent was issued on that. An attractive-looking approach, and you and I can now ask the question, is it practical to make a structure that's a little bit like a building, but this is an inflatable building, and the building is going to be 30,000 miles tall off the surface of the Earth. Whoa. That's a tall order. And it's going to have all kinds of gyroscopic stabilization into each one of the sections of the building to try to make it stable. And I guess it's going to correct itself for high altitude winds and all kinds of things. And it's just...
The first one is going to be 12 miles high.
And actually, I get the impression that the 12 mile high one is just to prove the concept. And so I guess one of the approaches is that by way of this 12-mile-high space elevator, you're getting above a significant percentage of the atmosphere, and then you launch your spacecraft from there, and therefore it doesn't require anywhere near as much rocket power, boost capability, fuel on board. Is that sort of the profit that you make out of this one, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's the way I read it, and they think that they're going to be able to take a rocket that's reusable, similar to the Falcon 9, you know, they're trying to take that booster and land it right now on an autonomous barge out in the middle of the ocean. And their theory is, well, they can land this thing back on top of this, you know. you saw what happened in the last two times they actually tried to land on it. I mean, they got close. I think they're going to make it, you know, within probably 6 months or a year once they get flying again after that. But imagine trying to land this thing on top of that thing. And then what do you do if you miss? I mean, this thing's going to come flying down and hit right below, right where this thing is supported from. And they didn't say where it's going to be supported from. The ground, the earth, the water, you know. So, but I mean, you know, it's a company that they've done a lot of things with the space program before. So, you know, they even had an experiment that they launched from one of the spacecraft. I mean, you know, I mean, they're not fooling around, but, you know, I'm not seeing this for a long time to come, Dick.
Yeah, one of the early questions you and I would ask, Paul, is what happens if a hurricane goes through or a tornado hits that 12-mile-high structure? Yes, it's got all kinds of built-in gyroscopic stabilization techniques and maybe the equivalent of guy wires. No, I'm having trouble with the guy wires because by the same token, if you've got a building that is a mile high and people are now proposing to build buildings that are a mile high, do you make one elevator go up that whole mile? And the answer is probably no, because the cable that goes from the top of the elevator to the top of the building and over that pulley, can you make a cable that can suspend its own weight for a mile of length when it's vertically held from the top without the tension at the top creating a failure of the cable? That's a very difficult requirement. So to put guy wires on this space elevator that's 12 foot high means the guy wires are going to be in the vicinity of 14 miles long, 15 miles long. Oh, what are you going to make that guy wire out of? I mean, take a look at the guy wires that are on a 500 foot high tower like you've got out in Manaville. These are massive guy wires that are about half inch, three quarters of an inch, something like that in diameter. I've got a piece of one of those that was thrown away in the garbage can, and I picked it up. A very exotic-looking wire. And when you hang a wire on a 550-foot-high, guy wire on a 550-foot-high radio tower, and you look down that guy wire, it's got a huge bow in it because of its own weight. And now you've got to put damping devices along it so that when the wind blows the right way, that wire doesn't set up a resonance that can create damage. So that's the degree of difficulty for 550 feet. Can you imagine a piece of wire that is, let me pick a number, 15 miles long, holding up a 12-mile-high structure? That's a tall order. And without that guy wire, I don't think the tower stands a chance of surviving a hurricane or a tornado. I don't think the patent went into any of those details. Did it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, I didn't read anything about the patent itself, but, you know, but I do know that they did successfully get a patent. I guess nowadays you can get a patent for anything, but wow. This inflatable thing, 12 miles high, I'm just not seeing it. I mean, I don't even know how it would support its own weight at 12 miles high. So, I mean, even if there was no wind, how's this thing going to stand straight up? You know, I don't care how much air pressure put in it. So maybe it'll have nitrogen jets mounted on the side, you know, where if it's starting to go one way or the other, they'll fire the nitrogen jets. I don't know. Dick, we're going to have to wait a long time to see a space elevator. I mean, even if they got it going, you know, now you got to put some kind of crawling structure inside this without cables. You'll have to ride up the side of it or maybe in the middle of it, some kind of a gearing setup. You're not going to have the cable. You'll have to crawl up. Wow. Back to you, Dick.
Once you've got the space elevator, whether it be the kind with the graphite-reinforced carbon ribbon graphite, graphite reinforced ribbon that's beyond the synchronous altitude in length, whether you've got that technique or this inflatable thing. In either case,